Welcome to Polo Life Past and Present. This is your host, Eric Ortega, and on this show today, we got an interesting interview, or should I say conversation, with a gentleman named George Harwood Phillips. Many years ago, Mr. Phillips wrote a book called Chiefs and Challenges, back in 1975. I talked with several people about this book, and many people have read it. Some people that were going to Palomar College, American Indian Studies, they kind of covered this book. They were interested in some of the culture, some of the history of the areas, local area. They read that book, had to do with the Antonio Garra Uprising. Pretty much the book ended around 1863, as far as the area time frame that it covered. Mr. Phillips has come out with a new book, a revised edition book. He's actually written several books, but this is the revised edition of Chiefs and Challenges. And it talks about the Indian Resistance Cooperation in Southern California from 1769 to 1906. So it covers a little bit more time than the original Chiefs and Challenges. And he's going to be talking with us today, discussing his interest in Southern California Native American history, how he got there, the reason why he stayed in that particular field. And he's going to also talk a little bit about this book. And here's a little clip from that interview.
Convincing my students, first of all, that all Native peoples weren't the same, because they'd often say, well, why didn't they unite? They'd always say that. And then my comparison was, why did it take a couple of centuries for Europeans to unite, when if you look at the map of Europe, every country there fought every other country at one time or another, that the Finns are different from the Spaniards. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that connected, but I tried to point out that a Comanche was a lot different from a Kaweah. Mm-hmm. And look at them as nations, like we see Europeans as nations. Mm-hmm. Most students, I don't think, taking European history courses say, why didn't the Europeans unite?
Now, before we get to that interview, got a little story by Rosina Lasquez, and this story is called Coyote and the Wolf. The story goes about how Coyote is out hunting. As he's going along hunting, he runs across a wolf. He finds some little creatures around to kind of snack on, I guess. Then running into the wolf, he asks the wolf, what's the wolf doing in his territory? And the wolf says the same thing to him, and they fight. Well, it comes to sort of a draw, and so he fights the wolf again, and this time he defeats the wolf. Unfortunately, as the story goes, the battle was so severe that when he got home, he did get sick and he died. But so he, in a sense, won the battle but lost the war. But it's a interesting story, and it's told again in the beautiful Pahnil language.
Ibi sewati ika kopayah kot. Maka nak tahu kuawe cuma kot isi hasil kaya. Ya mungkin panek. Ya mungkin dia kaya pun dah nawan kaya kot isi pipat tu. Maka dah hasil kaya mas lawan kot ni. Maka sulu tu mai kau tisi kapiu kalau kot ku ibu mih kau tu kau cipan. Cipan. Makut tipak kuliah ke ayen, makut kopi amper adik kaya kau harus pakai penanaman kau pahala kalau sebeg, kaya kau tish kupatte makut aku apal kampai kau na ayen ish pal, makut kau penanak kau imam pat muai peminuan, wisin am ya kau nak wisin am, makut pemu kuki ya peminuan pu makut tutul nikish. Kau pun kau awal tu memang kau isi kau pampih orang mendarat pelajar. Kau sembunyikan kau awal ya pergi kalkut. Maka pertama, anda kau cuma cik pergi kalkut. Kau pernah aku ni isi. Maka pemati ramen cuma mihkan. Kau pemih pakai pih aku pemih kau pakau kau isi maka pem. Pemkala kau isi payah itu je. Kau pergi orang diam, kau paham, kau masih bersulit nak balik kalau kau pemak kalau bi isi begini, kau khusyuk kalau kau nak pun paman. Kau diam, kau punan on, kau tak sepe kalau kau ting kalau kau punan on diam, kau tak isi pipat.
That was Coyote and the Wolf. Now we get into the interview. After the interview, we got a song by the In Trouble Bird Singers. So meanwhile, this is Mr. George Harwood Phillips talking about his book, Chiefs and Challenges. Again, this is the second edition, and it covers the Indian Resistance and Cooperation in Southern California from 1769 to 1906. Going to be trying to get some of these books in the area, probably at the Culture Center here in Paula. So give them a call down there and see if they have any available. If not, you can get them from the University of Oklahoma Press. So here is the interview with Mr. Phillips. It became Paula Life Past and Present. The premise is to have people see the history of Paula through the eyes of the people that lived here. So obviously, you would be a great one to interview for my show. Not that you've lived in Paula.
Well, I'm coming from the top down rather than the bottom up.
You're kind of looking at the whole history line from an outside point of view or whatever. Rather than a person being in the car, you're watching the car go by.
Both perspectives have their merit. My approach in writing history is to find, well, first of all, you want to be as accurate and as honest as possible. That comes with the being a historian, but to maintain some kind of balance and not be too judgmental, because in many ways the facts allow the reader to conclude more or less my conclusion, but without my pounding it into people that the Spaniards were all evil and the Indians were all good kind of thing.
Right.
So I know exactly what you're talking about there.
And so your name is George Harwood Phillips. College graduate?
Yeah, I did a PhD at UCLA.
UCLA, okay.
And then I've had a few teaching jobs. I ended up at the University of Colorado teaching Native American history and the history of the Southwest, which I, the Southwest history in some ways was, I think, a more balanced course in that I dealt with Indian, Hispanic, and Anglo cultures over the vast area, kind of succession of occupiers, if you will. And I brought California into it as much as I could, dealing with, you know, New Mexico and Arizona and parts of Texas. So, and then I taught a strict course on, or two semesters on Native American history. And one was, I just called it the Eastern Region, which was pretty much, you know, the beginnings of Indian cultures and then the arrival of the English and the French and so forth, up to removal, up into the mid-1830s or end of the 1830s, with some commentary that Indians didn't disappear. They remained, but so many of them were pushed, you know, into Indian territory. And then I kind of start all over with the Western region by looking at Indian culture as a whole, and then the Spanish coming up from Mexico into New Mexico and starting that process, and finally the Spanish coming up into California, and then the Mexican period, and then the degree of Anglo domination and pressure that came in different areas. A lot more serious here with the gold rush than, say, it was in New Mexico. Mm-hmm. Again, trying to maintain some kind of balance, as well as pointing out the role that Indian peoples played in the history of this region.
Yeah.
So that's my kind of the philosophy, if you will, of teaching this kind of course.
Yeah, and I think that particular point of view, which is your like the general point of view, not offense, not defense.
A survey, you know, kind of a top-down academic, you know, if you want to call it that, viewpoint. Whereas Native peoples, of course, have their own local histories coming up from, as you mentioned, coming up from their own local communities. Whenever, in doing this kind of Indian work on California, if I could ever find, and I did find, any Indian testimony or traditions that were relevant to the kind of theme I was developing, I got it in there as much as possible. So a perfect example, let's see if I can, haven't looked at this for a while, but a perfect example relevant to here is Chapters 12 and 13, which I deal with, first of all, the trials of the Warner Ranch situation and how it all ended up in the Supreme Court against the Indians, and then the removal. So I bet Chapter 12, there are a number of people mentioned who testified down in San Diego that people here would recognize the names. Because I got a hold of the records of the trials, and those defending Indians brought in Indians to testify on how long they had been at Cupa and Warner's, the Warner General Warner's area, and their testimony was overwhelmingly overwhelming conclusion that they'd been there for, you know, for millennium, whereas those defending Warner, the Warner Ranch people, Warner had gone by then, and finally convinced the Supreme Court that the Indians were recent arrivals. Guess who won that one?
But
the point I'm making, there's a lot of Indian testimony that I was able to recover and get in. So Indians are making a strong case, you know, for remaining at at Cupa and the other villages up there, and it was just, it's one of those clear cut cases of misjustice. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of them are, you know, you can kind of go either way when you're dealing with, say, land rights and that. This was just so clear cut that ultimately the Supreme Court would not accept what Indians had presented in their case. You know, so anyway, the point I'm making is that's in this book.
And, you know, one thing, well, there's a lot of things that come into play at the times. Like, for Indians weren't voters. Indians didn't have actually even a right to have say in a courtroom.
Right.
But it doesn't mean that what they said wasn't heard or anything.
Oh, yeah,
but,
yeah.
But as a politician, you wouldn't listen to it because they don't vote for it. They don't vote. So at that time. And a lot of those things come into play as well. You could see where an injustice, you know, could have been done. And like I said earlier, I always try to be not prejudicial on these things. But when you say, well, they brought in, but they went the other way. And it's like, you just got to laugh at it at this point. But
and again,
we're still fighting it. You know,
yeah,
we're still
part of my, if it's a philosophy, that's probably stretching it a bit. But point of view or methodology, whatever you want to call it, is that... if you present the facts of what happened when Spaniards intruded into Indian territory and Mexicans taking over and then Anglos coming in, if you lay out the facts as, you know, honestly, then you don't have to pander, and you don't have to pound into your reader your particular viewpoint, because the facts explain it all. And a lot of historians and those that are dealing with minority issues are often so proud of their position of being an advocate for that much of their writing is about how great they are in pointing out how badly other peoples were treated. I take the viewpoint that if we carefully lay out the facts, the reader's going to know
what
happened. And to me, it's kind of more of an understatement than an overstatement. And to me, understatements are more powerful than overstatements.
Yeah, because I think, too, that when a person is obviously slanted, you know, it takes away from their credibility. When you're on the outside and you're listening to all the facts and you see one guy who's and these ones are angels and those ones are devils, it already takes away from their credibility. If you just state the facts, everybody will see what the truth is.
Yeah, and the thing, too, is that I didn't shy away from when Indians are in conflict with themselves. Because at the same time,
as you obviously know,
when intruders were coming in, that didn't stop Indians from interacting in longstanding ways, both peaceful and hostile. Mm-hmm. And to overlook that aspect is again to put such a black and white kind of picture of what was going on. I mean, the great Cupeno chief Antonio Garra was captured by the great chief Kauai chief Juan Antonio.
Right.
So you can't overlook that. But that's not the main focus. The main focus is why Garra organized people to resist the Anglo takeover.
Mm-hmm.
That's the key. But you can't overlook the fact that another Indian captured him and turned him over to the. And that was because Juan Antonio was so pro-American. He was a shrewd operator, and he put his finger in the air and he said, "I might benefit by capturing this guy," because
mm-hmm.
and he did. He lasted another almost 20 years of his life and scared the pants off Anglos because they never could figure out what this guy was up to. So that there is a policy initiated by Juan Antonio that was self-serving or serving for the Kauai people when he captured Garra and turned him over. So the point being made again is that I don't emphasize this, but it's part of the larger story.
And it's something else that plays into everything that some outsiders don't know about Native Americans, is that as a Native American has a tribe, that tribe is sovereign, is an entity. It's not like all Native Americans are the same.
Right.
You know, which is a common belief, you know, that, oh, you're Native American? Oh, I knew a Native American from,
exactly.
Is he related to you?
And yeah,
I'm like,
yeah, yeah.
I mean, the chances of it, you know, I got family in New York.
Sure.
They're not Native American, but I do have family in New York. But that doesn't mean that because I'm from the United States, I know people in New York, you know. And that's one thing about that some outsiders don't understand, that when you got Juan Antonio and you got Antonio Garra, they're each making decisions that are best for their people. Antonio Gatto was in the gun sites of San Diego, whereas Juan Antonio wasn't.
Exactly.
And so he benefited. Now, I'm not saying what he did was right or wrong either, but you can understand that each individual was doing it for their own tribe.
I think I've laid out enough facts as to why he attempted this resistance. It failed. Of course, it failed. Mm-hmm. And it was probably doomed to failure because Anglos were still coming in large numbers. And, however, had it succeeded partially, without, say, the capture by Juan Antonio, that the negotiation position may have been stronger. And that often happened all over the West, where those that resisted sometimes got a better deal when the reservations were established than those that cooperated with the U.S. government. I mean, that wasn't always the case, but in some cases the U.S. government feared the Lakota more than they feared the Crow,
right?
And the Crow were allied in many ways as scouts and so forth with the U.S. They made decisions too. I mean, see, that's what I like about history. Any kind of history is that there's no simple explanation. It's so darn complex that maybe you should just withhold making, you know, total judgments.
Right.
But again, let the facts explain what took place. Convincing my students, first of all, that all Native peoples weren't the same, because they'd often say, well, why didn't they unite? They'd always say that. And then my comparison was, why did it take a couple of centuries for Europeans to unite, when if you look at the map of Europe, every country there fought every other country at one time or another, that the Finns are different from the Spaniards? Mm-hmm. I don't know if that connected, but I tried to point out that a Comanche was a lot different from a Kaweah. Yeah. And look at them as nations, like we see Europeans as nations. Mm-hmm. Most students, I don't think, taking European history courses say, why didn't the Europeans unite?
Right.
Because they know they fought themselves against one another for all these years. So that was one of the problems I had. And the other one was, in teaching history, is that, well, it happened, so it had to happen. And therefore, do we really need to know the details going up to the end of the topic that you're dealing with? It doesn't have to happen. I mean, the point we were talking about, if Juan Antonio had not captured Antonio Garro, certainly the uprising would have failed. I don't think there's any question about that. He just didn't have the manpower and the organization.
2,000 people is not enough.
But if he had lived to negotiate, as I said before, he might not have been executed. I might not.
Right.
So it didn't have to turn out. I put it another way. In general terms, I think we can say that the uprising wasn't going to succeed. But if we get into particular terms, things would have been different. Maybe not radically different, but different.
And in a sense, it could have maybe been, maybe not succeeded, but at least been successful in achieving certain goals.
Sure, sure. But I should just mention to the listeners that this book, Chiefs and Challengers, is a second edition.
Right.
And the first edition came out in 1975. That's the book I gave you when we first met.
Right.
The hardcover, or sent it to you. Whatever. And so this came out in 2014. So you do the math. I don't want to do the math. That's too damn long for a second edition. But what had happened in those 40 years is that so many people, both Indians and non-Indians, had contributed information that I didn't have access to when I first started.
Right.
So I benefited greatly from a lot of people that were doing, and both Indians have written stuff on this that was good, as well as whites. And so My first dedication in 1975, I think I mentioned a couple of people, Lowell being the anthropologist, and here I mentioned 20 or 30 people in the acknowledgement.
Right.
So much knowledge has been accumulated, and then I gathered new stuff myself. And this goes on. I ended the first edition in 1863 with the death of Juan Antonio, and that was a fairly good way to end, because Agara was executed and Juan Antonio had survived. But when I finished that, I knew that there was just so much more to say that I didn't, you know, have the time or energy to do it. So 40 years later, I found new evidence and took it up to 1906. When I leave the Cupeño and go back to the Cahuilla after Juan Antonio and take their story, the rise of two really important chiefs, Olegario and his son, who ruled the desert Cahuilla up until 1906. And the book ends with, not that Indians are living happily ever after, of course not, but it ends with, on the kind of positive note of cultural survival. And I've emphasized in my other works, I think that more than victimization, that somehow California Indian peoples got, not without terrible suffering and damage, but somehow got to the present. I find that amazing. I wanted to end this second edition with history coming full circle where the Pala people get the Warner's Ranch area back. That's kind of a selfish thing to say. I wanted you guys to succeed so I could end my book on a positive note. But both, you know, that would have been nice for both the Native peoples and just I like kind of resolution. This they lose the land and then decades later they get the land. Well, it didn't work out, or yet, I guess.
Yeah, we're still looking at it.
Yeah.
I did read your first book, and actually, you know, when I bring it up, a lot of people talked about how they had read that book way back.
Really?
Yeah, in, you know, 75, 78.
Well, good, because if you get a chance to read that, you'll see how much has changed. Mm-hmm. The heart of the uprising, the aftermath, The military tribunals that convicted all the Indians and the aftermath of the uprising, that's pretty much the same. But the preceding chapters and the following chapters have been significantly, they're brand new chapters.
Mm-hmm. So after 1863.
Yeah, right up to 1906. So it's a brand new book in that sense. So it's called a second edition.
That was Mr. Phillips. Now we'll go into our Bird Songs by the In Trouble Bird Singers. Take it away, In Trouble Bird Singers. Questions, comments, opinions, or ideas for interviews, give me a call, 760-742-4200. And this is Eric Katega saying, Ichang.